son. Oh, where is that boy? Son, you get up. It's after 10 o'clock. You want to sleep the day away?
Well, I suppose you do, but that's a waste of a weekend. Now, come on, you hear?
Did you call me?
Did I call you? I've been calling you for the past hour. Sleep was made to save life, not ruin it. Now, there's a few errands I want you to do for me. Are you listening? Well, first of all, I want you to go to Mrs. Shepherd's and get a spool of green thread so as I can fix that shirt for you. And then old Mrs. Sedgley next door wants some hauling done. Now, I told her you'd do it in your wagon. Son.
Did you call me, Mom?
Oh, heavenly day. I don't have time to scold you, boy, but this seems a funny way to spend a weekend.
Sleep is for weekends, ain't it? More sleep, not so much acceleration. That's what we need.
But here it is a lovely, cool morning when you should be full of pep. Where's your energy?
I left it in bed.
Oh, you rascal. Then when you're all done with Mrs. Sedley, you can... Son, did you hear? Oh, I give up.
Might as well, Mother, for there's energy in the sun, all right, but we just don't seem to be able to get it out. The son we're talking about on today's excursion in science is a good old S-U-N, however, who has more energy than we can appreciate, and it's more generous with it than our vacationing Wonder Man. We can see that the sun and stars seem to have unlimited energy, heat, and light, and we wonder where from and how. Why don't they burn out, and how long can they last? This is meat for today's excursion in science, conducted again by Al Zink.
Thank you, Bob Stone, and greetings, everyone. Bob, we'll need your help today in dealing with this, the liveliest topic of this season or any other. Bigger than any modern invention, hotter than any political issue, more powerful than any bomb ever can be.
What is?
The sun, Bob. Good old soul. We're going to try and answer some of the questions you mentioned a minute ago. The source and authority for all this information is Dr. Robert E. Marshak, Associate Professor of Physics at the University of Rochester.
To proceed without ceremony, just how much energy does the sun itself send out? We can feel its heat and know that energy is being sent off into space.
The first fact we have to offer is a staggering one. For Dr. Marshak tells us that the amount of energy which the sun sends into the outer world each second is the energy equivalent of 5,000 billion atomic bombs.
5,000 billion? Holy smoke.
And many stars possess luminosities much greater even than that of the sun. We are interested here with a century-old inquiry as to the source of all this power.
Don't tell me you, Al, have the answer.
Let's say we have a new idea on the subject, and the best one so far. It's called the carbon cycle.
How many ideas have been expressed before?
Not very many, for this is a tremendous problem. The first serious scientific explanation of the origin of the sun's energy was given more than 100 years ago. It was based on the idea that the sun's energy originates in about the same way a stone acquires energy when it falls to the earth. Since the mass of the sun is so high, a large amount of energy could be released just by the gradual shrinking of the sun under its own gravitational force.
Well, what's wrong with this idea?
Nothing, except that it's not big enough, for it can be shown that the rate at which the sun radiates energy is so great that the mere gravitational sources would have been exhausted in a time much shorter than the age of the Earth.
Which age is but a drop in the bucket, we assume.
Exactly. The only thing wrong with such an opinion is that it deals with something too merely mortal for a celestial phenomenon of proportions such as these.
Well, what is the next idea?
Someone thought we might connect the miracle that is radioactivity with stellar energy. This was around the turn of the century. But then this was refuted, for radioactivity is influenced by temperature, whereas astronomical data require a strong dependence of energy generation on the internal temperature of the star. All other explanations of energy production failed. In 1930, however...
Now we're getting down to brass tacks.
In 1930, Sir Arthur Eddington, an astrophysicist, had shown that the sun is a very hot mass of gas with an interior temperature of about 20 million degrees centigrade. At such high temperature, not only are molecules split into atoms and the atoms stripped into electrons, but the very nuclei themselves crash into each other and lead to nuclear changes.
Before we continue, Al, would you list these, you know what I mean, in relative size, atoms and electrons?
Let's start with a molecule, Bob. A molecule is made up of atoms, and atoms are made up of a center or nucleus surrounded by electrons. Now, these nuclear transmutations or changes we mentioned have been produced in a laboratory, and even then, atom for atom, a million times more energy than ordinary chemical reactions was released. But these reactions were very inefficient because we could not control the energy output.
But the fact that the sun is so much hotter might influence such a reaction?
A neat supposition, Bob. And in 1938, Hans Bethe of Cornell was led to the conclusion that a chain of nuclear reactions involving the nuclei of hydrogen, carbon, and nitrogen is responsible for the energy production in the sun. This chain of reactions was called the carbon cycle and seems almost certainly the source of the energy of which we speak.
Now, don't be surprised when I ask naively, what is the carbon cycle?
Well, Bob, I'm going to give it to you straight, and as I outline this description of action as stated by Dr. Marshak, assume that all these things have been observed and tabulated in laboratories. The carbon cycle is not just one nuclear reaction, but a series of reactions taking place one after the other.
All right, let it go.
The carbon cycle starts with a nucleus of hydrogen, called a proton, and a nucleus of carbon. The proton collides with the carbon nucleus, wiggles through the electrical repulsion which it experiences, and is captured to form a radioactive nitrogen nucleus.
Now, this is one of the transmutations of one element to another, which we've been told is possible in nuclei?
Yes. Then this nitrogen nucleus spontaneously emits an electron having a positive charge to form a new carbon nucleus, which moves around for some time in the hot gas inside the sun till it captures a proton to form a stable nitrogen nucleus. This nucleus captures a proton to form a radioactive oxygen nucleus. After another disintegration, a nitrogen isotope is created, and after more motion, the final reaction takes place. This time, the nuclear reaction is not a simple capture as before, but the nucleus breaks up into two large parts, one of which is a nucleus of carbon and the other a nucleus of ordinary helium.
I can't really follow that, but I'll be satisfied to know these things really happen.
These things really happen. That much has been proved. And when protons and electrons are converted to a stable helium nucleus, there is transpired a building-up process which releases tremendous amounts of energy. The energy liberated by 1 pound of hydrogen in this way is 10 times greater than that liberated by 1 pound of uranium in an atomic bomb of the highest possible efficiency. In fact, the store of energy is so great that our sun can continue to emit radiations at the present rate for 50 billion years without exhausting its supply of hydrogen.
That's the one point I failed to capture. In this process you've just gone through, is matter destroyed, created, or merely changed?
The most remarkable feature of the carbon cycle is that the carbon nuclei are not consumed, but are always reproduced in the same amount as they are destroyed. This is important for the economy of energy production in the sun. Although carbon is abundant, it is not as abundant as hydrogen. Therefore, if carbon were actually consumed, the fuel would be exhausted after a time, perhaps after 50 million years.
And as it is, we're safe for about 50 billion years, eh?
You and I don't have to worry about the sun going out, Bob. And we have good scientific evidence of the correctness of the carbon cycle theory.
The only place I've ever heard of molecules and atoms rushing around and banging into one another. And this business of radioactivity is in connection with atomic bombs. Is there any connection, really?
It's worth pointing out the similarities and differences between solar nuclear reactions and those which take place in the atomic bomb. In both cases, the energy of atomic nuclei is tapped, and the nuclear reactions, once started, continue on their own power. But here the resemblance ends. In the sun, the carbon nuclei are reproduced, while the uranium nuclei in the atomic bomb disappear forever. The most important difference is that the carbon cycle involves reactions between nuclei and protons, and the atomic bomb, reactions between nuclei and neutrons. This is the main reason why the release of such energy on Earth in practical amounts can only take place through nuclear fission, and not through some such series of reactions as in the carbon cycle. Atomic reactions can be carried on at room temperatures, whereas the carbon cycle takes place at the temperature of the sun.
Is there no chance of our making such temperatures on Earth?
It might be possible by means of an atomic bomb, but even so, we could not maintain such temperatures. We cannot imitate the sun on Earth, and the sun is self-sufficient. It is strange that in releasing nuclear energy, the sun works with the light end of the periodic table and builds up elements, whereas in the atomic bomb, man works with the heavy end of the periodic table and splits elements. It's a remarkable commentary on the rapidity of scientific progress that the existence of both types of reactions and processes was discovered within a period of 2 years, 1938 and 1939.
Thanks to you, Al Zink, and to Dr. Robert E. Marshak, Associate Professor of Physics at the University of Rochester, for such a wealth of information. And to those listeners who desire more detailed data on the sun and its energy, we can make available a science paper by Professor Marshak entitled The Energy of the Sun. Write to the station to which you are listening and ask for Science Paper 261. That's Science Paper 261, The Energy of the Sun. It's yours for the asking. And speaking of asking, some of you have already done some fancy asking. It's time for our answer session. This and all questions have been referred to members of the General Electric Research Laboratory and other authorities of equally reputable organizations. The first question is from a man in historic Ticonderoga who seems to feel he's having illusions, for he writes, "When I turn the pages of a book very rapidly under a fluorescent lamp tube, alternate lines of blue and red light appear. Can you explain this?"
Yes, we can. The phenomenon mentioned is caused by the different rates of decay of the phosphorescence of the two phosphors which are combined to make a white fluorescent lamp. Since the lamp operates on alternating current and the light output falls as the current goes through zero, the phosphor with a longer persistence will predominate at this point. The chemical which contributes the red portion of the light has a longer period of phosphorescence and predominates at the second this current goes through zero. That is why the gentleman sees red when rapidly moving pages allow him to notice this change.
Here's a situation, the helpful parent getting smeared up trying to help Junior. It seems this man got some of that waterproof crystal cement known as household or model airplane cement on his clothes and can't get it off. He's tried acetone and other solvents with little success.
Acetone is the most effective solvent for removing this type of cement. It's extremely volatile, however, and the best way to use it is to soak the fabric in it for about a half an hour, rather than sponge the fabric with it. Another method is to let Junior alone.
Our correspondent writes that he has heard it argued that a man has more endurance than a horse, and that a man could outwalk a horse if the man sets out to catch a horse that does not want to be caught. If the man had a supply of food and water and kept after the horse day and night, which one would have the longer endurance?
We put this question to Dr. Morris Fishbein, editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, who studied this and other related problems. He says that in a test of endurance between a horse and a man, the man will eventually catch the horse, not because he has more endurance, but because he has more brains. The man will provide himself with food, water, shelter, and so forth. The horse will not. The horse's endurance gradually will diminish, but the man's endurance will be practically unchanged. With patience, the man will eventually catch the horse. Dr. Fishbein adds that in the case of a sheriff catching the wild desperado, the same holds true. The sheriff has access to food, water, shelter, rest, and other necessities, while the outlaw does not. Consequently, the outlaw's endurance cannot stand up, and with patience, the sheriff will eventually catch his man.
From Montana, where thermometers really get a workout, a man writes that in one of his books, the word calibration is defined as correction as of errors in the thermometer. He's always understood calibrations to be interval marks on meters and gauges correlated with the graduations on measuring instruments. Can we explain this?
We can try. Calibration is defined in our dictionaries as the determination or rectification of the graduation of a thermometer. We believe that the definition in your book was referring to the latter meaning, rectification, when calibrations are defined as corrections of the errors in a thermometer.
Who built the very first automobile that was ever made? Asked an Altamont, New York listener.
The first person to build a self-propelled road wagon was Nicolas Quignot, a Frenchman. About 1770, he built a three-wheeled carriage propelled by a steam power plant, which had a reputed rate of 2.5 miles per hour, but it had to stop every 100 feet or so in order to get up steam. One of the original devices is still preserved in Paris.
Here's a final one for this time. A tourist ran into a sulfur spring and writes, "What form of sulfur is found in a sulfur spring and what causes the water to have a bitter taste and bad odor?"
Sulfur occurs in several forms. One may be hydrogen sulfide, the gas with the smell of rotten eggs. The rest of the sulfur present is principally a salt, such as magnesium sulfate, which gives a bitter taste.
Well, we've got to make an exit on such an unpleasant subject, but we'll return at the earliest opportunity for another excursion in science.